Now, some reaction to the Senate health care bill from the American Medical Association, which actually endorsed the bill yesterday. Joining us is the AMA's president-elect, Dr. Cecil Wilson, a Florida internist. Welcome to the program,
Jim. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Some of the features of the Senate bill that you've cited approvingly are increasing payments to doctors in underserved areas, not cutting payments to other doctors, not taxing cosmetic surgery. All those provisions would suggest that we're on track to keep spending just as much money on health care in the future as we do now, if not more.
Well, that list were things that were problems for us in the original bill, which the Senator Reid's manager's amendment took out. I think the bigger story is the fact that we're going to cover millions of people who do not have insurance and therefore at risk of being sicker and dying sooner. We're also, for those who have insurance, who are a pink slip away from losing their job, losing the insurance, we're going to solve that with reform so that there's no pre-existing condition, there are no lifetime caps on coverage. So I think those are the things that I think are the important story here.
But doesn't there come a point when, if we're going to actually reduce the nation's health care bill, then doctors, hospitals, laboratories will have to, at some point, make less money than they do now?
Well, cost is a challenge. What we're trying to do is to make care more rational. And to do that, we believe that covering people, and so they have, for example, a primary care physician, they can have continuity of care, they can get care at what's called a medical home rather than going to an emergency room where the care is the most expensive. So you're absolutely right. We do have to get a handle on, to be sure we're getting our money's worth.
In July, I asked your predecessor, Dr. James Rohack, about the absence of a plan to address medical liability and malpractice, which is a perennial concern of the AMA. He said, and I'm quoting him, "It's too early to say we're not going to play anymore. We believe, like a baseball game, we're in the second inning." That was July. I assume the AMA agrees we're in the ninth inning at this point. What do you make of the absence of malpractice litigation reform in this bill?
Well, we do agree. We think we're getting closer to the goal line. We continue to believe that an important part of health system reform is liability reform, and we know that experience has shown that caps on non-economic damages and on contingency fees is a way to control the cost. It doesn't get, though, at the defensive medicine, the fear physicians have of going to court and therefore ordering things that maybe they would not otherwise do that. So we are looking at a variety of alternatives like medical courts, so-called I'm sorry laws, the kind of arrangement where if a physician uses scientifically based performance measures, they have some protection in court. And actually, both the House bill and the Senate bill, we believe, does push liability reform forward.
I want to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Umdenstock, the president of the American Hospital Association. The bill that came out of the Senate, in the view of liberal advocates of a single-payer system, is an almost pointless compromise that doesn't do enough. In the view of Republicans, who nearly unanimously have opposed it, it's the hugest disaster to come out of Congress in all this time. In terms of sheer magnitude of the change of the health care system, as you foresee what's about to happen, how big is it? How significant a change is it?
Oh, it's big. And the thing we forget is what I alluded to earlier, and that is we're talking about millions more Americans who will have insurance so they can get the care they need they can't get now. And we will have millions more Americans who have insurance who won't have to worry about losing that insurance. That is big. And unfortunately, a lot of our conversation about some of the other issues has clouded over the reality that this is something we've been working on for a long time, and we appear to be on the cusp of making it happen.
You mean the discussions of such things as a public option or
Absolutely.
Abortion, which have not central to it as you see it. It does seem at first blush that if we're going to extend insurance to 30 million more Americans, and some of them will get a helping hand from the government, it's going to cost a lot of money.
It will cost, and I think we should not minimize that cost. But the reality is we're already paying a lot of that cost because people, when they get sick now and don't have insurance, they end up in an emergency room. They're sicker when they get there. So we're already paying a lot of that. It's just a cost-shifting kind of a measure.
Dr. Cecil Wilson, president-elect of the American Medical Association, thank you very much.
Thank you also.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. As we've been reporting this morning, an American Airlines jet skidded off the runway in Kingston, Jamaica during a rainstorm. No one appears to have died, but more than 40 people were hurt.
All along the East Coast in this country, airports are returning to normal after the winter storm that snarled air travel over the past weekend. But that does not mean your holiday travel this year will necessarily be easy. The days between Christmas and New Year's are among the busiest travel days of the year, and aviation experts say even if the weather cooperates, passengers should be prepared for crowded flights and perhaps some unexpected fees. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
If the airline industry's projections come to pass, this will be the second holiday season in a row when the number of people flying has gone down. The airlines expect to serve about 1 million fewer passengers this year compared to last, 5 million fewer than the year before that. Still, that doesn't make it any more likely you'll have an empty seat next to you on your flight. In fact, airlines have cut the number of flights so much that planes actually have become more crowded. It's a trend that many passengers noticed this week as they traveled for the holidays.
This is the Christmas spirit. My kids are coming home.
Yesterday at the Raleigh-Durham Airport in North Carolina, Debbie Castle met her daughter, who flew in from California, and her son, Philip Kirikoff, who came in from New York. And Kirikoff, who's 6 feet 6 inches tall, said his flight was especially tight.
Every seat was taken, so we're kind of crunched up, but unfortunately, I think that the airlines are getting much more efficient. So that's not so good for me as a consumer, but I think it's better probably for the airlines.
Indeed, airlines have cut the number of flights about 6% from last year, and the remaining flights in the air are about 80% full. Not only does that mean passengers will be packed more tightly, but boarding may take longer, and travel expert Christopher Elliott says you can expect more competition for carry-on baggage space.
The number one reason why people fight on a plane is over luggage, and the holidays is the worst time. Everyone wants to cram their holiday presents into the overhead bins. So if you're the last person on the plane, there's probably not going to be room for your one carry-on because everyone will have taken up that overhead space.
Elliot, a columnist for National Geographic Traveler magazine, says carry-on luggage squabbles have become more common now that most airlines are charging for checked bags. People who haven't flown since last Christmas should be prepared for higher bag fees, as well as fees for food, pillows, and almost every other onboard amenity. Elliott says most airlines even are charging a special holiday fee just for flying at Christmas time.
At a time of year like this, when everyone's talking about being nice and being charitable, when you have, you know, an airline that charges you extra for just about everything, it is not endearing the airlines to their passengers.
As is typical around the holidays, airfares have gone up in recent weeks, though airlines have waived advance purchase requirements on some flights, so last-minute ticket buyers can get the same discounts available to people who buy a couple weeks in advance. And Eric Torkels of TripAdvisor.com says there are hotel deals to be found as well, as hotels, like airlines, respond to the drop in the number of travelers.
Well, airlines can ground planes, they cut routes. You know, that affects supply and demand. Hotels can't do that as easily. They don't just close off the west wing of the hotel. So consequently, getting someone in that room for maybe less than they'd hope is better than having nobody in that room.
Yes, ma'am. How are you?
There will be a lot of empty hotel rooms this holiday season if what's happening at this North Carolina travel agency is typical. This is Maupin Travel, one of the oldest and biggest in Raleigh. And owner Tony Maupin says this holiday season has been especially quiet.
Probably this has been our slowest season since our doors have been open, and that's back in 1979. People call and say, you know, my husband or I just lost my job. I can't travel this year, or can you book me closer to home, or can they do it less expensive this year than last year?
Maupin says overall, business is down about 25% from last year, and he says as Christmas approaches, his customers have shown less interest in things like cruises, trips overseas, or other kinds of fun holiday getaways. He says much of the travel he's booking this month is for what you might call obligation trips, the family visits that people feel they have to make around the holidays, even if money's tight. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Last year, when the best-selling writer Michael Crichton died, he left behind a completed novel. It's set in the Caribbean in the mid-17th century, and it's about pirates. Here's Alan Chews with a review of Michael Crichton's Pirate Latitudes.
I just want to stand up and shout a hearty yo-ho-ho, because this novel is great entertainment without ever becoming bad history. It builds on an actual event in maritime records when a crew of English pirates out of the Caribbean port of Port Royal attacked a fortress on a Spanish island in order to plunder. I like that word, and it's what pirates do. They plunder a ship filled with New World treasure. The captain, Charles Hunter, is a daring adventurer who doesn't take no for an answer, though he has a mighty opponent in the Spaniard known as Cazalla, who commands the fort the pirates must subdue in order to take home the treasure. The story moves along like a ship with a great wind in its sails, carrying us through the siege of the island, an ocean chase, gun battles at sea, a hurricane, war with a giant squid, capture by cannibals, with a terrifically satisfying ending that is doubly surprising because it never veers from the actual course of events. Arg, me hearties, thriller fans, book lovers, here is your first great fun of the early winter season.
That's Alan Chews reviewing the novel by the late Michael Crichton called Pirate Latitudes. Now to the Internet and a debate over whether our time online is spent doing new creative things or recycling trends of the past. The hottest things on the Internet involve sharing what we've made or written. That extends from Facebook all the way to playing video games. Some academics argue that what we're doing isn't new, it's actually retro. Heather Chaplin explains.
Stick Beaterator in your PlayStation Portable, and suddenly you're a music producer. You lay down tracks, choose sound loops, or input your own. It's like having a mini recording studio in your back pocket. Evan Pavlovich is the music supervisor for Beaterator.
Anybody can pick this up and start making music.
Creating, rather than just consuming, is not unique to Beaterator. A lot of first-person shooters, for example, have editing tools so you can design your own level. USC professor Henry Jenkins calls it participatory culture.
Well, participatory culture, in a nutshell, is the application of folk culture practices to the content of mass culture.
In other words, 100 years ago, culture was produced by everyday people. Square dancing, playing the piano, quilting, telling folk tales.
The 20th century mass media crowded an awful lot of that out.
Sing-alongs, why bother? There were hits to listen to on the radio. Forget a game of charades, now there was television to watch.
We commercialized, we commodified the contents of our culture. So we created a world where a few people produced culture, the most majority of us consumed it.
But that was the 20th century. Now you can play a game like Little Big Planet, where you run obstacle courses in a charming world of mechanical objects and toys come to life. But the twist is that you design your own levels. You upload them from other people and then download theirs for yourself. You can fill the screen with pink squishy polka dots or black rubber slides. One player built an elaborate computer made of levers and pulls.
At the end of half an hour of play, you've actually created something which you're potentially quite proud of and which you then really want to show off. And that's the fundamental sort of mechanic at the heart of all of these games, I think.
That's one of Little Big Planet's developers, Alex Evans.
With Little Big Planet, we were really trying to convey that sense of empowerment.
I don't need a corporation to help me be creative. If we get into this frame of mind where we feel like we can't be creative without the help of a corporation, that would be really messed up.
MIT researcher and game designer Matthew Wise says these games are less about empowerment and more about owning your creativity.
They're kind of like colonizing your own creative impulse.
The biggest game developer in the world is Electronic Arts. It made Spore, where you start life as a single-cell organism and then create your own creatures, build your own village, invent your own landscape, and listen to tunes you yourself compose. In the industry, they call it user-generated content. When creator Will Wright first started talking about Spore, he said it could be a way of keeping game budgets down. And here's where participatory culture really isn't like square dancing and family sing-alongs of 100 years ago. The kid making creatures for Spore is doing the work of an animator. The kid making levels for Little Big Planet is updating the game, which gives it a longer shelf life. And every time a Beaterator player makes a song, he's going to tell his friends, which turns him into a marketer. Henry Jenkins.
But the company is not giving us economic compensation for that value, right? If you had to hire a marketer, you'd pay them. If you hired an artist, you'd pay them. But in this case, little Jimmy is both an artist and a marketer, and he's getting nothing out of the revenue that's brought in for that company.
Of course, little Jimmy is probably having an awfully good time, even as he's helping Electronic Arts keep game costs down. But new media expert Mackenzie Wark says there's something insidious about this kind of fun. He says it's really corporations co-opting and profiting from our natural drive to be creative.
Well, it might be creativity, but somebody is still extracting a rent from it. And the question you might ask is, who gets the rent?
Still, Henry Jenkins picks creating with corporate-controlled products over sitting blankly in front of a TV set. It is a way of influencing the culture, he says. Or at least gives us a fighting chance. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
And in this season of Tinsel and Trim, we offer now an audio bauble we hope will delight. On a visit to Paris recently, NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg took her microphone to a pretty special place, the apartment of the late fashion designer Coco Chanel.
She lived over the store, 31 Rue Cambon. Downstairs, the Chanel boutique and couture salon, where models showed her collections. Upstairs, a sanctum sanctorum, where closest friends were entertained. Today, the apartment is used for press interviews, fashion shoots.
And, of course, for haute couture clients.
Odile Babon works in the Chanel archive.
In this apartment, you can understand the universe of Mademoiselle Chanel, but the universe of Chanel today. So it's very important to see the apartment to understand that.
Coco Chanel had a design vocabulary, which her successor, Karl Lagerfeld, carries out today. Camellias, black, the double C logo, the elongated octagon shape of the Chanel No. 5 perfume stopper. And she surrounded herself with this vocabulary, her inspirations, in the apartment over the store. To get there, you climb a curved staircase, up steps carpeted in beige with white trim. When new collections were modeled, Chanel watched them from these stairs.
During the show, she would sit here on the fifth.
On the fifth step?
Yes, the fifth.
As in fourth. Chanel No. 5?
Exactly.
Five steps down from the apartment, the stair wall lined with mirrors.
So I'm standing on the step at the curved staircase in front of a wall full of mirrors, slimly cut mirrors, and looking down. And from here I can see all the audience's reactions to the clothes, as well as the models themselves.
But no one could see me, I mean her, Chanel, hidden from view, perched on a step. The upstairs apartment is like the nest of the most exotic bird, filled with antique lacquered Chinese screens, camellias part of the pattern. She flattened the burgundy-colored screens like wallpaper or folded them at the entryway to her drawing room.
Mademoiselle Chanel hated doors, and she hoped that by placing them in front of the door, her guests might not remember to leave.
Afraid of being alone, a design genius, a self-promoter, a fabulist, she made things up. Mademoiselle was some complicated character. Born poor, a series of rich and powerful lovers paved her way to fame and fortune. One, during World War II, was a Nazi intelligence officer. A pre-war lover, the Duke of Westminster, was the richest man in England. On a table in Chanel's apartment, some of his lavish gifts. Three cigarette boxes.
Did she smoke?
Ooh, a lot. A lot.
Those strong, rich Giten cigarettes. The elongated, octagon-shaped boxes are engraved with the Duke's coat of arms, silver on the outside.
And gold inside. So the more precious metal is not outside, it's inside. It's a luxury hidden from view. It's a luxury for yourself.
An important Chanel principle, says archivist Odile Babon.
And we call this notion the invisible perfection.
Chanel's apartment is filled with visible perfections, crystal chandeliers, gleaming mirrors, pairs of gilded Chinese horses, an ancient Russian icon from her friend Stravinsky, a shaft of wheat painted by her friend Salvador Dali.
It was a special gift for Mademoiselle. Yes, yes.
It's all so opulent, sophisticated, elegant. And yet,
what I notice is the size of this room. It's very intimate. It's not grand space. You just feel that you could sit with a few friends and have a drink in an intimate fashion here.
Each room is small, and an important room is missing.
Mademoiselle Chanel never slept here.
No bedroom.
No bedroom. No.
She had a private suite at the Ritz with all those ritzy amenities and service. Every evening, Mademoiselle walked 5 minutes from Rue Cambon over to the Place Vendôme, elongated octagon shape, and in through the rear door of the Ritz to retire for the night. And each morning, she crossed back to number 31. Nice commute. She would phone over first so they could spray the salon with Chanel No. 5. Then, in a mist of expensive perfume, Mademoiselle Coco Chanel got back to work. Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And you can make a virtual visit to Chanel's apartment at npr.org. Sales of new homes are expected to show a jump. The government is coming out with its latest report today. Yesterday, the National Association of Realtors said sales of existing homes jumped more than 7% in November. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
A federal tax credit of up to $8,000 and low home prices fueled November sales. Indeed, the National Association of Realtors says over half of the sales were to first-time buyers who qualified for the tax break. They scrambled to take advantage of the program, which was initially set to expire at the end of November. Congress has since extended the credit through next April. So far, an estimated 2 million Americans have taken advantage of it. Some of them, clients of Seattle real estate broker Tara Cummins.
They could buy homes that needed a little bit more improvement, or they felt like they could spend all the money that they actually did have saved, knowing that they would get a reimbursement on their taxes.
Housing prices remained soft in November. The median selling price fell, but the dip was the smallest in 2 years. Overall, the latest figures were good news for the economy, but some analysts caution that the housing market remains reliant on government support. The market isn't likely to see a sustained recovery until the nation's unemployment rate drops substantially. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.